he's pretty threatening. It's pretty serious. So that's why we're sending out more people.
State troopers search for a fugitive on snow machine in northwest Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 11th of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, deep cuts to the halibut fishery.
Some people will not be able to make payments on their loans from the fish that they catch, so it puts people in a very tough spot financially.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com.
The U.S. House passed a massive spending package that contains hundreds of millions of dollars for Alaska. The omnibus combines six spending bills, including military construction, transportation, and education, and costs $447 billion. Alaska's Representative Don Young voted against it with all the House Republicans. But Young says the package does send a lot of money to his home state.
It's a great bill for Alaska. There's a lot of projects in there, and the one question I had is, did it increase it's 24% higher than it has been in the past. And we do have some fiscal problems with that kind of money. It's a lot of it, but we did well, and I have to say that.
Young says his concerns about government spending led him to vote no, despite what he calls the good projects for Alaska. The spending package contains nearly $300 million for construction at Alaska's military bases, $10 million for the Denali Commission to support health projects, and more than $33 million to improve Alaska Native education. The nonpartisan group Taxpayers for Common Sense says the bill includes more than 5,000 earmarks, despite recent pledges by some in Congress to stop earmarking money for specific projects back home. The omnibus spending package passed the House 221 to 202 entirely with Democratic support. 28 Democrats joined all the Republicans in voting no. It now goes to the Senate. The House has also passed a sweeping overhaul of the nation's financial regulatory system. Congressman Don Young was one of only two members of his party who did not cast a vote today. The rest of the House Republicans voted against the bill, but it passed with Democratic support, 223 to 202. Young's office says he didn't vote because he had a previously scheduled obligation. Congressman did not support the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act and called it a step down the slippery slope to socialism. The law would create a consumer protection agency and give the government the power to intervene when banks deemed too big to fail are in trouble. It would also create a council of regulators that would watch for risks in the financial industry. Supporters say it's necessary to protect the American economy from an event like last year's near collapse of Wall Street and the ensuing economic crisis. They also say it would help consumers. But Republicans say it's overreaching, and Young says the bill would, quote, do nothing but increase prices and reduce choice for Alaskans and for the country. The Senate would have to pass the Reform Act before it becomes law. President Obama says it's a top priority. Alaska state troopers have been chasing a man between villages in northwest Alaska who is considered armed and dangerous and is accused of two separate attacks. Trooper spokeswoman Beth Epstein says 26-year-old Kotzebue resident Jason Douglas Black has been eluding troopers on a snow machine since the beginning of the week.
We've been looking for him since Monday when we got a report that he had sexually assaulted a woman in Kiana.
Ibsen says troopers went to Kiana on Monday to interview the assault victim.
By that time, or shortly after, we got the call that he was in Norvik and he had assaulted the village police officer there. He had threatened him with the rifle. And he's very mobile. He's on a snow machine. He knows the area. He grew up in a village there. And plus there's cabins in between the villages. So he's been very elusive because, you know, he's on a snow machine. He's zipping between villages.
Ibsen says Black reportedly has an AR-15 rifle. She says two troopers started the search on Monday, with a third in Kotzebue helping to coordinate the effort. Others are now joining.
9 more troopers that are in the process of going up there. Some of them probably have already arrived. We have 2 members of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms and Explosives joining the search on December 9th.
Ibsen says anyone who sees Black should not approach him, but instead call troopers. She says there is a $1,000 reward for information leading to his arrest.
He does have 2 warrants out for his arrest for 2 different charges. One is a $25,000 warrant charging him with first-degree sexual assault from the incident in Cayenne, and the other one is a $25,000 warrant charging him with the felony third-degree assault in Norvik.
She says while troopers were searching for Black, they also made 4 other arrests.
You know, that's why our search has been hampered. You know, we've got this armed and dangerous man going around the villages, and unfortunately, we've had these other 2 felony assault cases pop up. It's been keeping us very busy. That's why we're sending up more resources. But the fact that he's eluded us for this long, and we've been getting reports that he's pretty threatening, it's pretty serious. So that's why we're sending out more people.
She says Black's last known whereabouts is the village of Selawik, but he also has ties to Shungnak and could be in that area. Halibut stocks remain on the decline, according to U.S. and Canadian fishery managers, who are calling for another round of cuts to the commercial harvest in much of Alaska. Southeast would be hardest hit, with a reduction of 26% for commercial longliners. The International Pacific Halibut Commission staff announced its 2010 catch limit recommendations this week. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
The Halibut Commission staff is proposing a total harvest of just under 49 million pounds for Alaska, Canada, and the Pacific Northwest. That's a drop of nearly 10% from 2009. Going up the coast, catches in the Pacific Northwest, Area 2A, and Canada's Area 2B would drop by 20% and 14%, respectively. The biggest cut would be in Southeast Alaska. Southeast is called Area 2C, and the recommendation is for a catch of about 3.7 million pounds there, 26% less than in 2009. There have been improvements in some areas, according to Halibut Commission Director Bruce Lehman, but he says the Southeast stock is still showing decline.
You know, we've seen a continued decline in the indices we're using to monitor the stock. We did see a little bit of an improvement in the survey index of catch rate this year. And we had seen, we've now seen 2 years worth of that in Area 2B, and we're seeing some improvement in Area 2A, but we haven't as yet seen that in the commercial index in Area 2C. We're optimistic that we're going to see a turnaround here, but this is another fairly significant hit for 2C, and I really wish I had better news for 2C.
This would be the 4th year in a row of deep cuts for the commercial halibut fleet in Southeast. Halibut quota share holders and crew have already seen their allowable catch drop by roughly 54% in the last few years. The latest recommendations would mean a 65% drop between 2006 and 2010. Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association Director Linda Bankin says the cuts have a huge economic impact for the fleet.
Particularly for people who purchase quota share and are paying off loans on that quota share to now have that much less fish to catch, it makes it very painful. Some people will not be able to make payments on their loans from the fish that they catch, or even be able to pay off what they own on loans by paying the quota share. So it puts people in a very tough spot financially.
And Bankin says longliners are worried about the halibut stocks as well. The Halibut Commission's 2010 catch limit recommendations for the commercial fleet include an 8% drop in the Gulf of Alaska Area 3A and a 9% drop in Area 3B and 4A. In the Aleutians, there's a 16% increase recommended for Area 4B, while the allowable catch in Bering Sea Areas 4, C, D, and E would drop by about 6%. The IPHC will decide whether to approve the staff recommendations at its annual meeting in January. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, after 4 decades, Native people in the Bristol Bay region get allotments.
I think that they've done a good job with processes like this ANCSA 14C land transfers.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. What would you do with an extra $56 a week? Well, that's how much you're spending if you smoke one pack of cigarettes a day. At $8 a pack, that's $240 a month, $3,000 a year. Think about it, and think about quitting. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-888-842-7848. It's free, and it works. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
After nearly 40 years, Bristol Bay's regional village corporations have finally completed the transfers of all settlement claims lands to its local native residents. The lands were originally awarded to the regional corporations with the passing of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971. From member station KDLG, Adam Kane reports.
Last week, State of Alaska Commerce Commissioner Emil Nuri announced that the filing of the map of boundaries by the village of Igyagik marked the end of a long journey for Bristol Bay's 29 native village corporations. It all started in December of 1971 when the U.S. Congress passed the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, calling for Alaska Native Village corporations and landholders to adopt policies and accept applications to make final land claim determinations. The lands were made available to native residents, businesses, and nonprofits, as well as airport operators and communities as a whole. Keith Jost is a program manager for the Land Managing and Mapping Program with the Division of Community and Regional Affairs. He says that many of Bristol Bay's village corporations completed the transference of lands in the 1980s and 90s. However, a few, like Igyagik, had issues to resolve from earlier land transfers.
Began with the passage of the Act, but there was many things that needed to be done to get the lands to the village corporations, and then they would be in the position to take applications from people who were on the lands in 1971.
All of the lands were held by the local village corporations and had completed the land transfer process with the assistance of the Bristol Bay Native Corporation. Josh says that the BBNC has had a positive influence on the village corporations throughout the land claims process.
Because of this model that the regional corporation has had, I think that they've done a good job with processes like this ANCSA 14C land transfers.
Some other regions have yet to complete all of their land transfers, and Fry isn't sure why that is, but he attributes the successes found in the Bristol Bay region to the unity of its local village corporations. The 29 villages found in the Bristol Bay region include all of the villages from Ivanhoe Bay and the Chignecks in the south to Non-Dalton and Port Ellsworth in the north. In Dillingham, I'm Adam Kane.
More Alaskans are leaving tonight for the United Nations climate change talks in Copenhagen, Denmark. Members of the Yukon River Intertribal Watershed Council will be attending both as observers and presenters. Brian Miracle is the Watershed Council's lead scientist. He says the council operates the largest indigenous observation network in the world, maintaining 39 fixed station sites that cover the Yukon Basin and measure water quality. He plans to talk to other indigenous people at the climate meetings about the Yukon Observer System, and he'll also be on hand to be a translator of sorts for technical and scientific information for the Watershed Council attendees.
Our chair of our board, Clarence Alexander, and one of our leader advisors, Peter Captain, will be the main focus of our trip there. And so I'll be there helping to disseminate scientific information to them.
Miracle says he wants to help make sure indigenous voices are heard and recognized as climate change observer experts.
To talk with different scientists, to really get a sense of what the larger countries are thinking about doing related to climate change impacts and how that we can be effective at building adaptation strategies around climate change.
Peter Captain Sr. is a former Galena resident and Loudoun Tribal Council First Chief. He is a vice president of the Tanana Chiefs Conference and an elder advisor for the Watershed Council Board of Directors. He says Native people in northern countries have been reporting climate change observations for 50 years. One of his goals is to make sure his children and younger generations understand the changes and recognize them.
We travel the river a lot, you know, and you can see the permafrost right in the bank, and tell them, you know, that's what's happening. That's, you know, global warming, and there are, you know, sometimes a whole lake would disappear, you know, due to due to permafrost melting. Foundations on buildings, you know, starting to, you know, waver because of the melting permafrost.
Captain says he hopes President Obama will make some firm commitments to curbing carbon emissions during the Copenhagen gathering, but he says he hears and knows of the pressure from climate change skeptics.
As an indigenous person, we've been fighting these battles ever since, you know, day one. So we need to make people aware that unless they start doing something to curb these, you know, these emissions and whatnot, that, you know, we're all going to perish. You know, there's not going to be anything left for our children and grandchildren.
The Yukon River Intertribal Watershed Council's chairman, Clarence Alexander, will give a presentation in Copenhagen next Thursday evening, December 17th. The state's Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner Larry Hartig will address the gathering next Tuesday, the 15th. The State Game Board has received several proposals for re-upping and expanding protective corridors for wolves on state land on the eastern edge of Denali National Park. Current buffers, which protect wolves from hunting and trapping along portions of the Stampede Road and the park's highway, are scheduled to sunset. One of the expansion proposals is from the National Park Service. The agency has long opposed environmentalist efforts to increase the buffer, but Assistant Superintendent for Resources Philip Hoagie says the current situation justifies expansion.
What motivated us was an increase in the harvest of wolves, and almost a doubling in the last 5 years, where it went from 17% to 30%.
Hoagie says the proposed buffer zone would substantially increase the area where wolves are protected in the vicinity of the Stampede Road in an area known as the Wolf Townships. Under the park proposal, the buffer zone would go from the current 92 square miles to 169 square miles. Hoagie says it's aimed at protecting three wolf packs that frequent the park road.
We don't feel that this is by any means a population issue. The wolf population at Denali is doing quite well. This is a wildlife viewability issue, just to ensure that that folks who come here do have an opportunity to see wolves.
Hoagie says the park used GPS collars to track the movements of alpha wolves in the three packs commonly seen by tourists in the summer. He says the park has consulted with the state on the research and proposed buffer zone increase. The Park Service long resisted pleas from wolf biologist Gordon Haber to increase the buffer zone along Stampede Road. Haber died in a plane crash while tracking wolves in Denali this fall. The proposals will be considered by the board during a meeting in Fairbanks in February. There will be a public comment period on the proposals prior to the meeting.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Former Governor Sarah Palin will be in Alaska this weekend for her first book signing in the state, but only military members or their families will be allowed to attend. Palin will sign copies of her book Going Rogue on Sunday afternoon at Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage and in the early evening at Eielson in Fairbanks. The general public will not be allowed at the events. Elmendorf Public Affairs Chief Captain Ashley Connor says the venue was set up through the Army and Air Force Exchange Services, or ACES.
They brought former Governor Palin to all of the AFES installations across the DOD. So it's not just here in Alaska, and it was sort of set up at that headquarters level. So we were just, you know, told that she was going to be here on Sunday.
Connor says Palin's base visit won't incur any extra security cost at Elmendorf because it's a closed event. Chris Ward is an ACE spokesman. He says the organization runs retail facilities for the DOD.
We run the stores, the restaurants, better known as the Post Exchange, the Base Exchange, worldwide. Over 3,000 stores, 30 countries all around the world, Iraq, Afghanistan, anywhere they shop downrange is going to be an APHIS facility. And the funds that we generate go back to the military community.
Ward says having authors, music, and sports stars on base for signings is not unusual.
Gosh, we've also had some people with political backgrounds as well. And, you know, like I said, also a lot of artists, you know, rap artists that put out CDs, they'll come there and sign and have a signing. So it's, we call it retailtainment because it's retail and entertainment combined. It's called retailtainment. So it's just a, you know, it's a great avenue for them to pitch their product and support the military at the same time.
He says AC sometimes asks individuals to come to the bases for events, and other times authors or musicians request the venue. He says in Palin's case, he doesn't know for sure who initiated the visit.
Oftentimes it's their people contacting us to say, hey, we'd love to do this because so many people like to support the military. Other times it would be, you know, we have our in-house buyers, like our book buyer, for example, might contact the Palin people and say, how about, you know, her coming out and signing some autographs for the troops. So it's a combination of the two, but we do quite a bit of these signings. You know, they'll have authors come in, entertainers come in, actors come in, people just come in that want to do stuff for the military. And it's, you know, it's win-win for both because it's great publicity for them and it's a great morale boost for the military.
Ward says beyond the Elmendorf and Eielson signings, there are potentially two more Palin book signing events at bases in Hawaii, but he says those have not yet been confirmed. A call to Palin's publicist at HarperCollins was not returned. One of the most scenic subdivisions in Alaska has been the subject of a cell phone tower controversy over the past few months. The Talkeetna Community Council has unanimously voted to ask the Mat-Su Borough Planning Commission to reconsider a request from GCI for a tower near Denali State Park. KTNA's Sue Dio has the latest on GCI's attempt to provide for customers in the Denali State Park area.
Residents in the Sun Glow Vista subdivision, adjacent to the McKinley Princess Wilderness Lodge along the George Parks Highway, received notice that GCI would like to erect a cell phone tower between their front porch and their view of Mount McKinley. AT&T erected a tower near the same area, behind the McKinley Princess Lodge, several years ago. The tower is hidden by a hill to the east of the lodge. Since that time, AT&T has been the sole provider of cell service in the area. Due to borough code, the AT&T tower there is only 120 feet tall. GCI said after surveying, the AT&T tower is too short to add their equipment. Making the tower taller and co-locating would place that tower under the tall tower regulations in the borough. GCI went to a new plan, which was to lease land and ask to erect a tower close to the same location. A simple solution, just add another tower. However, the Planning Commission meeting in which public testimony was heard was heated and emotional. Dave Stringer is the GCI site acquisition specialist working on the project. The
Planning Department asked us to go back and work with the community in lieu of a judgment on our 100-foot pole that we proposed. So that's when I went back and set up the community meeting with the people up there, and we sat in somebody's cabin and we just hammered out issues, you know. What I took away from that was that the co-location was what everybody wanted. So that's when I went back up to the Global Tower and, well, how can we skin this cat and make it work? You know, we sent a man to the moon. Why can't we make it work?
Stringer says he thinks placing another 20 feet on the AT&T tower and placing their equipment there is now the answer. Then not only would GCI have a place on the tower, but so would Sprint, Digitel, a GCI-owned company, and Nextel. Stan Turner, owner of the land that was leased to GCI for a new tower, only commented that he had not been in most recent meetings and thought a number of people with the not-in-my-backyard syndrome had swayed the Planning Commission. Borough planners, meanwhile, are working on a revised overall tower plan that might make a difference. Alex Strawn is the planner on the project.
If the regulations were in place, they could raise it from 125 to 140 through an administrative process. And so it's kind of an expedited process. It doesn't have to go before the Planning Commission. It's approved by the director.
At the latest Talkeetna Community Council meeting, Stringer convinced the council board that adding 20 feet to an existing tower was the preferred alternative. After lengthy discussion, the council voted to write a letter asking the Planning Commission to approve a conditional use permit. The Borough Planning Commission looks at GCI's conditional use permit again December 21st. The borough's tower ordinance final draft goes out for public review in early January 2010. In Talkeetna, I'm Sue Dio.
Fairbanks winter tourism will take a major hit as a result of Japan Airlines' financial woes. Fairbanks Convention and Visitor Bureau Tourism Director Colin Lawrence says the struggling Japanese carrier is cutting back on winter flights to Fairbanks.
Currently, we're looking at 9 total round-trip groups coming as opposed to 18 last year, so pretty much cut in half.
Lawrence says the economic downturn and swine flu concerns are also playing a role in a general decline in Japanese travel. The 50% reduction in direct JAL flights equates to about 2,000 fewer Japanese tourists coming to Fairbanks this winter. Chino Hot Springs Resort is a popular destination for Japanese tourists, and Assistant General Manager Jenny Kirsch says they're trying to find ways around the lost JAL flights.
Our Japanese agents are actually working with Northwest Airlines and other carriers to bring in more people. So we aren't sure how that's worked yet. They're still in the selling process, but we're hoping that that will bring more people.
The VCVB's Lawrence says some visitors will take less direct flights through Seattle and Anchorage. He says the dramatic reduction in flights wasn't expected given the airline's success in the Fairbanks market in recent years. Lawrence says Fairbanks isn't giving up on the relationship with JAL. It spent years developing as a key part of Fairbanks' winter tourism marketing. Current JAL partner American Airlines and arrival Delta have been making competing offers to bail out the Asian carrier. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Adam Kane in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Sue Dio in Talkeetna. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. Pennair, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at pennair.com. And by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business with data transfer speeds up to Gig E. ACS, connecting Alaska companies to each other and the rest of the world. If you smoke, odds are you want to quit. If you want to quit, you're probably finding it tough to do. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. The average smoker tries 10 times before they quit for good. You can increase your chances by calling the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. Give it a shot. It's free and it works. Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-7848. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.